Okay, yes we can't. Yes we can or yes we can't? Okay. So this was a nice introduction. This is joint work with Adam Young. We've been doing it for 15 years. Started it about 15 years ago, so it's a little bit perspective and a little bit retrospective. And well, I was introduced, the guy said, you know, I don't know anything. I don't can't even say these things. So, sounds like nonsense, indeed, admittedly. All right, so what is it? So, cryptovirology is the study of applications of cryptography, and I'm a cryptographer, to malicious software. And we first published it, started publishing it from 96, and kleptography is in some way the other way around, that it's like the application of malicious software to cryptography. So in some sense it's investigating how modern cryptographic paradigms and tools can be used to strengthen and to improve new malware. And just to give you the perspective of the time of the initiation of this work, it's the mid-90s, the big Schneier book, Cryptography is Going to Save the World, the big equalizer, everybody can write cryptography and have secure systems. And applications are to defend computers against all evil, and so on. And the adversary are the bad guys, and we use the crypto against them. So, if everybody thinks this way, you might as well think the other way. So that's what we did. How to use cryptography on the attack side of computers. Not that we wanted to attack, but it's interesting to see the scope of what can be done with a technology like cryptography. So we started in 96, in 2000, shamefully it's kind of a commercial break here. We wrote a book in 2004 that is called Malicious Cryptography Exposing Cryptovirology. And that was about 9-10 years into the investigation, but I'll cover a little bit more here. And the way we decided to look at it is as a technology. So we view malware or software that like viruses that people considered bad simply as a technology, neutral view. And then the idea was to look at malware that tries to hide its presence, conceal secret information despite attempts to reverse engineer, can withstand certain faults, like people try to trace what it does or where it comes from, and so on. And the idea was that this will give insight into what must be done to protect against these threats. Because when you... It's upon security professionals and hackers, and I love hackers because they always teach me new things. You have to always look for threats. And if you have any sense of responsibility, you also have to look for countermeasures to those threats. And that was in this line of work. And what we did is not something about breaking systems themselves. You know, virus need to penetrate system in some sense. But it's about the exploitation of this combination of technologies once breaking into the system has been achieved. Okay? And we started simply as applications of cryptography to viruses and other malware. And somehow during this investigation, we also got to investigate the opposite. How can cryptographic Trojans can be inserted into crypto systems and what attacks they can do. So that's interesting demonstration of that you get to something that you don't start with. All right, so a little bit about history of malware. I'll be very brief here and I'm going to omit a lot of the history. Just a few lines of important development, because they say we treat malware simply as technology. We don't say it's bad or good, just what it is. So in fact, we can trace malware all the way back to von Neumann. And the reproducing finite automata idea that he had. An automata that produces output, and the output is the description of the same automata. That was the first replicating program, and this was already in the 40s, when almost nobody here was alive. These viruses were alive, but we were not. In the 50s, especially in Bell Laboratories, it was the hobby of various geeks, Claude Shannon among them. Core Wars is an example of viral software that was used for games. And then in the 60s, malware was recognized as a threat to integrity and availability of classified information. The documents from the department, the USA Department of Defense, and the notions of access control, mandatory access control, and so on. If you read the documents from the 60s, you see that they were very much motivated by this conceived threat. In the 70s, advanced malware design begins, and also advanced realization that crypto systems can carry information that was not intended to by Simons. And maybe this information that can be carried inside the crypto system can be a Trojan. In the 80s, viruses start to appear in the wild. So this comes together with the PC revolution, home computing. And Cohen started to investigate viruses from an academic point of view. And a famous event is the Morris worm that spreads across the internet and takes out parts of it. And the realization of the global threat of something that can start as an experiment in one location and can spread globally was realized. In the 90s, major viruses with major impact, when I say virus, I mean worms and so on various commercial systems, and people start measuring, using money, how much you lose on a virus, just because of disruption. I want to point out one interesting design, actually implementation and design from the 80s, and this is the survivable Trojan horse of Ken Thompson in 84, 25 years ago. He described it in his Turing Award lecture. What he designed is effectively a survivable password-snatching Trojan horse. So, password snatcher is a program that tries to infect the Unix password program or file and to log passwords. And the design goal of to show how systems are getting complex and threats are getting serious, he designed a Trojan horse that survive recompilation and reinstallation of the password program on the host machine. So he demonstrated that it's not just the application itself that needs to be protected. And I have the description here, but I will skip it. But I'll get to the bottom line. The bottom line was that essentially the Trojan was using the C compiler to increase its survivability. And then if you replace the C compiler or the password program, just the smart operation of this Trojan made it survive and re-replicate inside the system. And the bottom line of this was what he showed is that one cannot just scrutinize the trustworthiness of a program by analyzing the source code and by compiling it. And in some sense, the entire machine must be scrutinized because he used something that was hiding in the compiler. So the source code, the compiler, linker, assembler, operating system, that you cannot, when the threat comes from one source, you cannot just go there. It really is spread around. The academic studies by Cohen in his PhD thesis in the 80s, he started to investigate viral countermeasures. And bypassing these countermeasures. So what he noted is that the idea that a virus can have can change itself in the replication process, and he produced something that viruses that has no common sequence of over 3 bytes between each generation, and he called it evolutionary viruses. And nowadays, you know, we know about polymorphic viruses. Also in the 80s, it was shown that the problem of whether a program or a set of programs has a virus or doesn't have a virus is undecidable. The meaning is that there is no universal treatment, and at the same time, the antivirus heuristics based on scanning and signatures started to be developed. Another something that happened in the 80s is worms were invented as a paradigm for distributed computing in Xerox PARC, among other innovations. And as I said, polymorphic viruses are now known threats, and they employ cryptography. To begin with, I'm not getting into the detail, but there is a decryption header that decrypts the program. The program can execute. When there is a replication, the decryption can be done with another key. So you can see how cryptography can generate many viewpoints of the same encrypted piece of software. So this was already something that existed as an application of cryptography to malware when we started. So, you know, you can do many changes and it's easy to exponentially explode the space of possible viruses, and as was noticed in the early 90s. And the other piece, so this was the state of the art when we started. The other piece of the picture that we wanted to include in our technology is public key cryptography. And for the sake of this presentation, I'm not going to give a lot about public key cryptography, but all you have to know is that there is a public key denoted Y there, and it has a corresponding secret key X. X is kept by the key owner. Everybody can encrypt E of Y and the message, get the ciphertext CI. Everybody can decrypt it. But the knowledge of Y and the knowledge of does not enable to the decryption of the ciphertext back to the message. Only the one who knows X, this is called trapdoor information, can take the ciphertext and the secret key X, apply a transformation denoted D, and which is the reverse operation to the encryption, and gets the message back. So this was the idea of Diffie and Hellman in the late 70s, and the first example of it was the RSA, which was based on factoring big numbers, that there is a number n that is multiple of p and q, two big numbers, and you cannot factor them. You cannot factor, you cannot take eth root, therefore you can take a message and raise it to the e mod n. Only if you can factor, you can recover m. And applications for this is encryption, key exchange, digital signatures, and various protocols that have been suggested in the last 30 years, like playing poker over the phone. Okay. So now, don't get to the subject of cryptovirology. And I will review three topics. The first one is cryptoviral extortion. This is an active attack. The second subject that I will cover will be deniable password snatching, which is a passive attack where the combination of cryptographic technology and other available modern channels that are available in the infrastructure enables us to provide the attacker with deniability of being identified. And the third topic that I will just mention is computationally secure information stealing, kind of a virus that you know the virus, you have all the traces of the operation, and still you don't know what the virus was stealing. Okay? So these are the types of things that you can do when you start combining these technologies, this public key cryptography on the one hand and viruses on the other. So, wow, how can such research be justified? But I don't think this is the right conference that I need. I mean, I should have erased this slide. Everybody understand. You have to hack system, you have to break system, you have to think about threats. And this will help society. If you get the right cooperation. And I'll talk about it later. So let's go directly to the setting of the cryptoviral extortion. So assume the following setting. The host computer has valuable data. I call it D, capital D. And due to laziness, the usual laziness, at the moment it's not backed up or not fully backed up. And assume you wrote a virus that has access to secure random bit generator. It has entropy extraction in it, something it can read the environment and get kind of truly random bits from the physical devices. The virus has a code for secure symmetric cipher, like AES, say. And the virus has access to code for secure asymmetric cipher. This is the public key encryption. So it has, let's say, a program for RSA encryption. So here is the more or less the cryptoviral extortion attack. And this is a protocol between the attacker and the virus. And let's go and see what's going on here. So the attacker generates a private key, X, and corresponding public key, Y. And the attacker places Y in the virus, but keeps X to himself in his own machine, not connected to anything, nothing. Not the internet, not anything. And then the virus arrives at the host machine. And I said, this is not the part of the talk, how to get there. But we got it. It's there. So what does it do there? It activates. It generates a random symmetric key, K. So a key for AES, say, decrypts the big file D, capital D, with this key K, obtains C. So C is the encryption of D under AES. And then encrypts the key K that was used in this encryption with the public key Y to obtain a ciphertext small c. The virus deletes the data D and the key K. And then informs the victim of the attack, gives contact information for the attacker. You know, hopefully not directly, but some digital information, some anonymous Swiss bank account. And then the victim contacts the attacker and gives the attacker C along with the ransom because it asks for some money in step 4. Step 5, the attacker obtains the ransom, and since he wants to play nice, at this point he can run away with the ransom. But if he's smart and wants to be in business, he should take C, use X, which is the asymmetric key that he has, that he is the one that has the ability to decrypt with it, and from C, using the key small x, obtains small k. The key k is sent to the victim, and then the victim, in step C, obtaining k, can decrypt capital C and get the data D. So you see what happens? Somehow, there is this game that we designed. And by the way, if you have questions, just come here to the mic and disturb me in the middle. So first of all, security of this attack. So analyzing the code of the virus reveals the public key Y, and not the private key X, because it's not there. And we know with public key, just knowing the encryption key Y, that is not sufficient for decryption. As long as the symmetric key K is not captured, if the virus is written right, then in short time it is erased after the decryption, and there's no way to recover K because it exists only in encrypted form. The encryption can be performed also incrementally if you want to avoid detection. This is virus technology. And then there are variations. You don't necessarily have to extort money. You can get data and so on. And communication can be done in an anonymous way and so on. So this gives security to the attacker. So so here, that was the way to show that the power of public key cryptography is such that there is really unequal powers here. The attacker has the decryption key, and he's the only one that has the decryption key, and he has to be involved in the recovery. So before the involvement of public key, such an imbalance of power between attacker and attacked host did not exist, and this is the right tool for this imbalance of power. So previously, the virus could disrupt, could have done delete things and so on, but never move the power to release the information to the attacker, who is remote and is not even present during the operation of the virus. Okay, so that's the first idea. The second idea that I will cover is password snatching that we did, and a typical password snatching scenario. And we did it in '97, so the examples are of that technology. But technology just worked in favor of this attack that I will talk about. But so. So password snatching was conceived in the multi-user machine environment, and the password is to steal login and passwords. And the classical solution is that the attacker installs a Trojan, like a keylogger, that collects login and passwords pairs, store them in a hidden file, and the attacker later downloads these files to get those things. And the drawback of this classical attack is that the attacker is at risk when he or she installs the Trojan, and also when retrieving the login password information. Okay? So the idea of the deniable password snatching was, again, to use the power of cryptography and more or less public channels to make the password snatching attack deniable, such that all public actions by the attacker do not necessarily tag the attacker as the attacker. Anybody else could have done the same actions. So the attacker first writes the virus to spread the Trojan, hopefully remotely. Then the attacker releases the virus. And the idea in step two is to release the virus in kind of anonymous spread. So the example that we did when we thought about it is, stores it on some floppy disks and leave it in a public internet cafe. That was the technology of that time, but you can think about better anonymous channels nowadays. And then in step three, the virus infects the machine, installs the Trojan. The Trojan store the The asynchronous, the asymmetric encryption, namely the public key encryption, Trojan, and when it collects login and password, encrypts it with this public key crypto system. And then the idea is, in step three, to broadcast back the this information to the internet, or when we worked about it, on it, the idea was that unconditionally copy it as to anybody that copies information from this machine. So at that time, somebody puts a floppy in the machine, copies information, but you put there also the hidden file. In modern technology, you can think about the Trojan post the file on some bulletin board or some other things like this. The idea is that the information that was collected is sent back to the public. And the public includes the attacker. Many people can download this information, but they don't have the decryption key. Only the attacker has. So the attacker, when he gets the information, he can decrypt and get the login and password information. And the others, because of the use of public key cryptography, for them, this encrypted information is useless. So if the attacker is caught that he has the public file, nobody, you know, many people got copy of this public file through the broadcast encryption, and they downloaded it, but they cannot do anything with it. So anything in the public record does not tell you who is the attacker. And as long as the distribution of the virus was successful and the broadcast back of the information was successful, only the attacker can take their information that it got back, put it on his own machine that is not connected to anything, and then get the login information. And this was a way to use public key cryptography plus these distribution channels and collection channels to hide the attacker. And only the attacker gets it. There is confidentiality to this attack because he's the only one who can decrypt the information. Everybody else who gets the encrypted file cannot decrypt it. Okay? And as I said before, these channels of broadcast channels to and from the user has just been improved over time. Botnets, mixnets, and so on. The third threat that I wanted just to mention is this computationally secure information stealing. And the idea is to take a virus that searches for a specific information and then steals it, put it in some storage, or stores it in itself and then moves it back to the attacker. And you get the code of the virus, you get full trace of everything that the virus was doing, and you don't know what was he looking for. Let's say he looked for a salary of certain person in an organization and puts it in the virus itself and started copying back, and it gets back to the attacker. But nobody, just looking at the virus, looking at the trace, is able to see what was done. So again, with the power of cryptography and with the power that you can process the entire salary file, pretend quote unquote, encrypt everything, but actually encrypt only the right thing without anybody knowing, even if you have full trace of what was done, is possible to do with cryptography, with cryptographic techniques. So there is a way to steal information without anybody in the world but the guy who wrote the virus, the thief, knowing what was stolen. I will not give the details here, they are a little bit more complicated. But it's possible. So I will not cover more attacks of this nature, but I will give a little bit retrospection what this shows. This development shows us. So Thompson, as I said, showed that you cannot clean the system by considering the application layer only, or by considering the virus and the password infected program itself. The scrutiny is, you have to scrutinize the entire system, the entire system component. And in open system, the entire system with the internet can be, and with viruses, the entire system can be outside our control. It's not necessarily the one machine you have control over it. And then with cryptovirology, this combination of public key technology and viruses, in these open systems, sometimes after the attack, the only way to recover is by considering the attacker itself outside the system. Or the only, you have to take care of the example of the recovery that you need the attacker, or the fact that you don't know what information was stolen, and only the attacker can tell you. So ourselves, we can't. And it doesn't matter how much power you are going to put in it, you have to break the crypto in order to do it. And that's, you can show it. That information theoretically, of course you can, but you have to break the crypto. So from the complexity or the power of the crypto, you cannot scrutinize the system. You need the attacker in order to scrutinize the system. And that's the step that was shown here from a retrospective into those types of attacks. Okay, so we described it, and we described it in a book, so we got reactions. So it's good to see the reaction. So I told you before, the book was in 2004. So here is a reaction from a famous virus book writer himself who decided to write a critique of a book. Since I wrote a virus book, I will never write critiques of other people who write virus books, because for me it's a conflict of interest. Okay, but let's see what this fellow wrote. He wrote, is the volume supposed to be a serious warning against a new form of malware? Blah, 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 blah. So he's doubting the goal of this book. And then he says, in addition, much of the material concentrates on building more malign malware rather than dealing with defense against it. So he noticed that we really wanted to have fun. Good. And then, instead of criticizing us, he's criticizing the community of virus writers. He said, I'm not too worried about virus writers getting ideas from Young and Young. Implementing crypto properly is a painstaking task, and from almost 20 years' experience of studying Black Hat products and authors, I'm fairly sure there would be lots of bugs in what might be released. Okay, so he doesn't criticize us, he criticized the virus writers who are, you know, hackers, I don't know, they don't know crypto, whatever. Okay, good, fair enough. Some director in some funding agency told us, we do not consider these attacks as high priority or immediate. Okay. And then we had reactions to the reactions. I pointed out to these, some people that, you know, what we do is a kind of very cheap way to do denial of service using this power of asymmetric, of public key cryptography. Adam took the criticism a little bit more seriously and he said, wow, who needs to know cryptography? So he implemented a version of the active attack, this ransomware virus employing CAPI, Microsoft's cryptographic API, so to verify that you don't really need to know cryptography, you just call the API. You have to know the word encrypt, you have to know the word random. Good. I told him not to worry about such things and not to worry about criticism. Criticism is healthy and challenging, and that's fine. And I told him that, you know, the only thing that really worries me is... We suggested some obvious countermeasures, extensive backup and recognizing crypto operation where they don't belong. And I was worried that the antivirus forces, those that claim to do antivirus, they don't pick on it. I don't see them getting ready to what we pointed out. So okay. So as a result, we had some other ideas and we didn't even bother to publish them. In this direction. And then, around 07, strong ransomware employing public key cryptography started to appear. So virus spreading started using botnet, which is very similar to the password snatching channel that you don't know who is the attacker, and ransomware that asks you for money. So the conclusion is the bad guy's business is to try to make money, and they ignore recommendations from heads of funding agencies and book writers that write criticism of other books. Simply, they want to make money. And of course, there are various discussions about whether these attacks are severe, important, what they are, you know, how serious they are there alternative attacks? I'm not getting into this. I'm just pointing out what we did and what was done, and you be the judge. Okay? So this is the current state of affairs regarding these cryptovirological attacks. Okay? So then we kind of abandoned writing about cryptoviruses and concentrated more and still concentrating on something that we call kleptography. So it's a play on words. It's a combination of cryptography and klepto, which is theft. So we noticed that in those malware designs, we always have kind of a crypto Trojan horse core that was doing cryptographic work. And then there was a spread mechanism that was a virus that was replicating through the system to get access. So in some point in the investigation, and we don't remember when and how and who, we raised the question, what if the crypto Trojan that does the crypto work instead of putting it in a virus, put it inside the crypto system. And Simmons observed already in the 70s that certain ciphertext and public key values have redundant information on them, so they can carry information that was not intended. So we said, aha, maybe. So the thing that we try to investigate is if a crypto system is in tamper-proof hardware, which people thought to be the most trusted way to implement crypto system at the time, then no one knows what algorithm runs there. Okay? So the manufacturer of such highly trusted tamper-proof hardware, instead of putting the benign crypto system, the RSA crypto system, can put the Trojan crypto system. And I'm very worried nowadays when people talk about trusted computing modules and some of them have certain tamper-proof properties, and I'm also worried about open source code that even though it's open source, nobody reads it. So open source, when it's cryptography, read it. It should be open Windows source, not just open source that everybody ignores. The idea is, so the fundamental idea is that there are ways to implement cryptography in a way that looks to everybody like it is doing the right thing, but not necessarily so. So what we did as a first step, so we generated the crypto Trojan that runs RSA key generation, that randomly generates composite numbers, N, which is really a multiple of two strong primes, P and big primes, P times Q. It uses real randomness. It's not monkeying with the generator, weak generator, and things like this. It's really strong. And it looks random to everybody, and it is secure. So it has first proof of security that this is as good as any other RSA key that you generate. I'm talking just about the composite. But the Trojan's creator has a trapdoor that from N itself, namely the bits of N, it looks at N and it has an algorithm to read the factorization of N, written inside N. Any other reverse engineer cannot factor. Yes, we can't. Yes? Cannot factor. The attack is exclusive, and here you need a second security proof, security of the attacker, exclusivity of the attacker. So the bottom line is that you have to trust the producer of the tamper-proof hardware or the producer of the software if you don't look at the software, not just the fact that the device looks good. Okay? So keep the bottom line in mind. I'm not going to cover this. It requires another talk. But keeps the moral of the story. And I will move to conclusion first. So I showed you several malware attacks, either general malware or Trojans. I mentioned just Trojans inside crypto systems. In each attack, the public key of the attacker was used by the malware to make the attack robust in some sense. Keep the attacker anonymous, hide the malware, what it is actually doing, this is the stealing, give the attacker exclusive ability to decrypt data, and so on. So it uses the cryptographic power of public key cryptography, a technology that was invented in the late 70s, in a very specific way. Some of the attacks were active in nature, like extortion or leaking the private the factorization of the RSA number. And some are passive, like hiding channels or information stealing that you don't know which information was stolen. And probably there are the other attacks of this nature that exploits this imbalance of power between the guy that creates a public key and knows the trapdoor and the rest of the world. And technology can be used and abused. Technology is neutral. It's what we make out of it. Crypto API was not generated by Microsoft for my collaborator Adam to write a virus, but you can do it. Public key cryptography was generated for encryption and signature, not for these attacks, but you can use it for the attacks. Ransomware has been used. I think also the deniability has been used in some way. For those of you who are in the area of detection of such attack, the use of availability of technology should be well controlled and managed, not from the point of view of government control, but as an operational control on a system. Access control, who does what? And nobody, it's not that if you run your system and you manage it, you have to know which parts of the system are allowed to do what. There's something about threats. Always look for new possibilities of attacks. It's very, very easy to come after the attack and say, ah, there was an attack. The idea is to predict attacks 10 years before they occur and respond to them before they occur and not just be reactive, you know. Zero-day attack. Be ready for them if you can, if somebody told you. And everything around us, system, internet, and so on, everything, attackers are getting more sophisticated. We need to be proactive. So I call this, I titled this talk, Yes, We Can't. Why Yes, We Can? Because crypto has positive applications. And then cryptovirology showed negative applications. So we can do great things with crypto, but it can also prevent us from foiling certain attacks. So it has negative application. But then we can take cryptovirology and turn it, malware and crypto as technology, and employ it in a positive way. So you can turn cryptovirology to produce distributed agents that are robust, survivable, for example, or nobody knows what they do. So you do distributed computing, and even though somebody does the work for you, he doesn't know what you do. And you can turn kleptography to key recovery methods that don't use additional work than just generating a key. So they are also positive. So the negative applications have positive applications, if you wish. So, you know, it's a strange world. So yes, we can. Conclusion, further conclusion, assurance of systems component is tricky business. Cryptographic crypto systems show this. There are implications for testing, black box testing, impossibility of black box testing, and complexity of trust relationships in a system. And when suggesting new trusted hardware or new software that you want to trust, be careful, as I said already before, but it won't hurt if I say it again. And we need to be ahead of the attackers if possible. So usually talks end with conclusions, but I will end with in conclusion. What is trust? Again, Ken Thompson already in 84 showed us problem with trust. The title of his paper is Trusting on, you know, on Trusting Trust. Cryptovirology some breaches of trust. Recovery is at the mercy of the attacker. Yes, we can do it. Yes, we cannot do it on the inside of the system. Cryptography, trust relationship, go beyond the boundaries of the system. You have to trust offline elements, the designers, the manufacturer, and so on. Yes, we cannot just trust black box component. Trust is a very tricky notion, and if somebody claims they understand it, they probably don't. Thank you very much.
Yeah, so thank you for the talk. I'll finish the talk now. Thanks a lot.